Okay, what we're going to do is call this the Hess meeting to order, and corralling legislators are like corralling cats, believe me. And right now, with the PPT tax discussions going on in resources, both of these fellows, I've pulled them out of resources, and because they realize the importance of this, they're going to stay as long as they can, but they have stepped out of their resource meeting and are willing to come and listen, and so I'm very pleased about that. And so right now what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn the meeting over, I'm going to turn it over to you, Ira, and let you introduce the people, and we'll listen, because then I'm sure afterwards, and as long as these two fellows are here, what I'm going to do is do it a little different than we did earlier, because I don't know how long I can keep them.
Okay.
If they have questions as we go along, we're going to ask questions. So
we'll
let you go right ahead.
Thank you, Representatives Gatto and Seaton and Chair Wilson. For taking the time. I know it's been very busy over there, and there's a lot to absorb, and so we particularly appreciate you coming on over and spending some time with us. And because your time is limited, we're going to kind of scrunch everything we did this afternoon in an hour and a half into 15, 20 minutes, and give you some time to ask us some questions. We are here, of course, representing the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Task Force, mm-hmm. and we've come together. It's a broad coalition of folks from across the state and representing the business sector, the not-for-profit sector, K-12, the preschool, the Alaska Native community, all of whom recognize that this is a significant issue in the state, that a lot of our young kids are not coming to school, coming into kindergarten and first grade, really ready to learn, ready to read, which is a great deficit to them as they proceed through the education channels. We have two special guests today, and we're going to turn the spotlight on them. Coming in from the lower 48, our two guests are Robert Grunewald, who is the associate economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, who's going to speak to us on the kind of unlikely situation, unlikely subject of how early childhood development is, in fact, good economic policy. And then we have Bridget Chandler from the Washington State Governor's Early Childhood Commission, about what they're doing down in Washington, and also specifically focusing in on the science of brain development and why it's so important from that perspective to take advantage of the growth of brains on young kids. So I think what I'll do, I'll turn it right over to the two of them, and they have a nice brief PowerPoint, and when they've done their presentations, you can ask all the questions you want of them or any of us, and we'll be glad to answer for you.
Okay, and I might let them interrupt even as
that'd
be fine. As each slide is up. So.
Okay, so first, Rob Grunewald from Minneapolis.
Rob Grunewald, Associate Economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Thank you, Chair Wilson, and the rest of the representatives and everyone else here today. I'll give you a very abbreviated version, so you're not going to see all of my slides. If you want to see the rest of them, they're in the packet. But at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, we've been investigating the research on early childhood development and how this research really shows that investments made in children before they reach kindergarten has an impact on the economy. And the way we make this linkage to the economy is that we've leaned on some research we've read, but also research presented by Jim Heckman, who is Nobel laureate economist at the University of Chicago. And what we've all discovered together is that when we look at all of our investments in human capital formation, because of the sensitive period between birth and five, that what happens during this time really sets a trajectory for kids, that on average, by the time they reach kindergarten, they're on a trajectory towards success or being at risk for failing in school. And there's some key longitudinal studies that have been able to show the economic impact, particularly among children who are at risk for developmental delays before they reach school age, and what happens if we provided this cohort of children with a high-quality preschool program or high-quality childcare program that includes parent education and support. One of the key studies that we looked at was the Perry Preschool study. And I will walk you through the results of this study. It was conducted in Michigan, Ypsilanti, Michigan, just outside of Detroit, Michigan, very socioeconomically distressed community. And children were selected to participate in this program and then were randomly assigned to the Perry preschool program or to be in a control group for comparison. And the children that were in the program had a daily classroom session, and also the teacher visited the family's home to work on parenting skills. And they tracked the children of both groups until they were 40 years old. Here's just a couple slides that illustrates the effects of this program. First, they found significant education effects in terms of their achievement scores during school, also the percent that graduated from high school on time, and also significant differences in requirements for special education. Then at the age of 40, the researchers found significant economic effects. These included the percent of children who later owned their own homes and made more money in the workforce, which correlated with their higher levels of education. They were better workers, they had more skills, and therefore earned more money. And as to a side from the Federal Reserve, I included this last statistic, the percent of these kids that actually are involved in the formal banking system. Crime rates were essentially cut in half, looking at felonies and down to misdemeanors. Essentially all these crime rates were cut in half. And so we have a number of benefits from this program that we can then convert to dollars so that we can evaluate the relative benefits of the program relative to the cost of the program going in. The cost of the program in today's dollars is about $10,000 per child. On average, these 3 and 4 year old kids were in the program for about a year and a half. They found savings to the K-12 system due to reductions in special education and reductions in grade retention. Then there were higher participant earnings. Most of this goes to the participant as a private benefit, but some comes back to the public in the form of higher tax revenue. And then, particularly for the Perry preschool program, there are strong savings due to the reductions in the needs of the criminal justice system and also to the cost of crimes to victims. So once all of the benefits of this program are added up and evaluated relative to the cost, the ratio is 17 to 1 in terms of dollar value for every dollar that was invested. At the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, we converted this benefit-cost ratio into an annual interest rate so we can better compare the return on this program with other investments, not only in the public sector but also the private sector. The total annual rate of return is 18%. Most of the benefits accrue to the public. We estimate the public return at 16%. And even relative to investments in the private sector, for example, the returns on the stock market for the last 25 or 30 years, adjusted for inflation, were 5 to 7%. So very strong rates of public return. There are three other longitudinal studies that I cite here briefly that all had benefit-cost ratios over 1, so of course they pay back for themselves, but all of these programs show significant savings, and they, in terms of internal rates of return, they range from 7% up into the lower 20s percent. I'll end on this slide. I'll just hit each one of these briefly. Some of the lessons that we learned from the research is that it's important to invest in quality. That is, the qualifications of teachers in center-based programs or parent educators, that they have the training to do the job, and that they also focus on involving the parents in the education program. Reaching at-risk children is where we'll find the strongest savings, because that's where we can reach kids that potentially would be more of a liability later on in our school systems and, let's say, our criminal justice program, but we can help those kids become assets to society. And the research shows that focusing on both a mix of emerging numeracy and literacy skills, but also the social-emotional components of the child's learning, is very important in finding ways to bring these programs to scale and reaching large numbers of kids is key. And I'll just conclude by mentioning that in Minnesota about a year ago, there was a group of business leaders and community leaders that came to the legislature on a day similar to this called the Minnesota Business for Early Learning, representing about 100 different organizations, many of them private companies, and asking the legislature to join them in a partnership towards identifying those practices, those programs that can most cost-effectively provide early education to the children in Minnesota. And so today, I see this happening here in Alaska.
I want to make a comment, too. Both of the legislators on each side of me are also on the Budget Committee for Education, so they're some key people that we want to let them know all about this program.
Who are you?
Yeah, I guess I am, too. What I'm looking at, too, even for higher education, lots of times, especially in Alaska, by the time people go to college, we're having to do a lot of retraining and bringing them up to date, and it costs a lot of money to do that. And so even in areas, there's so many ways we can save money along the way, and so that's pretty exciting. So I'm anxious to hear about the brain research, because okay. I think if people get that in their head and understand, then Representative Seaton has a question.
Before you leave, has Minnesota expanded the program to be across, or has any other? I mean, this was a pilot program, right?
It's a pilot program. This community and business leader group, combined with the state, has pooled some monies together, and they're going to be using these funds to fund pilot projects, and from the lessons learned there, they're going to identify what programs that have been existing in Minnesota are working well, and also what they've learned from these pilot programs, and see what would be the best path to go forward.
Thanks.
What was the length of the study? From how many years did it take?
The Perry preschool program? Mm-hmm. It was a 40-year study. So they started in the early 1960s, kept track of these kids very well. They only lost about 5% of the population. But at age 40, they were able to survey them. The other three programs I mentioned surveyed the children at age 15 for one of them and about 21 for the other two.
So they haven't been as long?
Not quite as long.
Okay, thank you. Bridget, I've seen this, but this is exciting information. The research, most of this research, Bridget, has it happened just in the last few years?
I'll make up new stuff so that you're entertained.
Okay.
For me. Speaking as a scientist, no, I'm kidding.
You don't mean you're making up the data, do you?
I would never imply that. No. Madam Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity to address your committee, and members of the committee appreciate your willingness to fit your very, very busy day, make time for this early learning presentation into your day. The data that we can talk about really briefly are relatively new, but the message that they bring is really age old. I mean, the data are showing us from the inside of the brain what's going on that many teachers and parents have always known is true, you know, that we're connected, that we're curious, and that the higher the quality of the relationship that children are in, the more likely they are to learn and to remember and to thrive. And so neuroscience, in a way, is sort of an unlikely messenger to really reinforce these messages that it's all about parents and the loving connections that parents and caregivers provide for young children that really sets the trajectory for their school and life success. So what I'd like to do is just show you a couple of pictures of brains and what we know about brain cells. And, you know, there's nothing like being able to really see, in terms of brain operation, what we have been able to observe and to appreciate in a little bit more vivid detail just how exquisitely capable young children are, but also how vulnerable they are. And, you know, to really try and close with the message that you've got an incredible opportunity here in Alaska with this task force that has come together across sectors to say, you know, we might be starting late, but we can really learn from the examples of other states and make some great strides on behalf of all of Alaska's children. So with that, let's just take a quick look at, you know, what we are learning about the brain. And the first observation is that early brain, you know, it is growing so dramatically quickly in those first years of life.
Are these infant brains? Or
These are pictures of adult brains. And what you will notice in terms of brain growth, you probably have heard this phrase about, you know, the brain is 90% developed by age 4 or by age 5. What people are talking about there is the actual physical volume of the brain as an organ, these glial cells, these sort of architectural cells that hold the brain together and allow these neurons to grow and connect. Is just proliferating at this incredibly rapid rate from birth until about age 4 or 5. So the head itself, I mean, the brain inside the head has grown physically very dramatically, disproportionately to the rest of the body during those early years. And so we've been able to notice that just from watching children as they develop. But what the technology allows us to do now, which is new in the last 10 years especially, is to look at healthy human brains while they're operating and to get a sense of how rapidly these connections form, how they endure, that those early circuits that get laid down are there for life, and that our later learning is building on top of those circuits, and that we're very vulnerable to damage in these very early years. What the neuroscience is also telling us is that we have these innate capabilities. We have this innate drive to discover our world. You know, children by their nature want to use all of their senses to try and figure out, how does the world work? You know, who am I? Who am I in relation to people around me? What can I do to get my needs met? And the human brain, compared to other brains that have been studied, are hugely what scientists call undifferentiated at birth. You know, most of our brain development occurs after birth because we're so adaptive by nature, because humans live in so many different kinds of environments, so many different kinds of situations where different sorts of skills are necessary. And so comparing like a human brain to a spider brain, you know, there's enormous difference in terms of the growth and the connection and the development of a human brain over a lifespan compared to a spider brain, which pretty much gets what it gets at birth and knows how to weave and passes that information on in terms of genes. But what we're able to see now is actually how those connections form inside the brain, how they endure, what damages them, and importantly, how they heal. And so this old debate that raged for many years really now can be put to rest about, is it nature versus nurture? You know, is it genes that pretty much determine who you're going to be, or is it your life experiences? And the answer is it's both. You know, we are who we are because of this inextricable dance of the DNA that we got from mom and from dad and the experiences that only we have, that we process in our brain, that either allow us to develop the capabilities that our genes dispose us to, or to not experience the benefit of what we could have learned or could have been capable of had we had the experiences to nurture that. So nature and nurture, it's both. And so, again, taking a look at, you know, what is the scientific evidence for how brains develop and connect? And, you know, the story here is that we are learning at birth. And actually, even in utero, there's very new research that shows how, you know, you might have heard the number 100 billion brain cells. We have 100 billion neurons at birth. And it may well be that we've got twice that many at the peak of brain development in utero, and that we're adapting, especially late in the third trimester, to mom's well-being and to her level of nutrition, whether she's smoking, drinking, drugging, her mental well-being, all has a huge effect on the developing brain. And so we're adapting as we're developing, and especially in those early years. The old story, again, within a 10-year time frame, an old story was you have all the brain cells that you're ever going to have at birth. And now there appears to be, that is not entirely true, that there's new evidence that our brain can actually recruit cells from other parts of our body and grow new brain cells in response to damage, disease, injury, which for those of us who are on the other side of that free fall of synaptic pruning that happens naturally after 21, this is great news that our brains can not only heal and make new connections, but can actually grow new brain cells. And this is relatively new research. But what this shows is that there's this healthy pattern of proliferation of connections that peaks, you know, early in life, and then tapers off as our brain becomes more selective, as we reinforce the circuits that our experience tells us are important for us to master. And I love to use this phrase of how, you know, by nature, we're looking to the people around us to figure out how we're supposed to act, what's safe, what isn't safe, what's rewarded, what isn't rewarded. I mean, we look to the big monkeys. How do the big monkeys do it? You know, and the big monkeys are showing us, and we are, by our genetic instruction, very, very good at imitating. So imitation's a very, very powerful strategy for learning. And that's what's going on in those early years, as children are just drinking in the experiences around them, dramatically forming connections, and then again, based on experience, either the brain keeps those connections or lets them wither. And we want that to happen. You know, we want to become more specialized in the things that are important. And what we want to attend to as the grown-ups is, what are those experiences that our young children get? So what learning is represented in those synapses that were made stronger, and what was lost in terms of what connections were either never allowed to strengthen or never allowed to flourish? So again, we're very adaptive. We want the experiences that children have to acknowledge them as individuals, that while there are many rules of how the brain develops that we all share, at a certain point, every brain is absolutely unique and individual because only we have the combination of our genes and our experiences that we have. And so in the optimal situations for children, you know, we know a handful of things that we believe to be necessary for optimal development of all of our children, and then we want that to be tailored.
Give us some for instances.
Children need to be safe. You know, their physical body needs to be safe from too much heat, too much cold. They need to be safe from physical injury. They need to be in a situation of adequate nutrition and health care. So, you know, very basics in terms of a certain amount of predictableness in the routine that they experience, and particularly in terms of caregivers, whether it's the parent or whether it's caregivers outside the family who are attending to the child, to have predictable and reciprocal relationships. I mean, I think everybody would agree that that forms a core of just basic human need. And when those needs aren't met, our body responds by going into a stress response. Our autonomic nervous system says, wow, you know, you haven't been fed, or you've been crying and crying and, you know, reaching out for some sort of interaction, either because you're bored or you're overstimulated and you're not getting what you need. And when that need isn't met, we have an automatic physiologic response where a series of chemical reactions is set off by the brain and by our adrenal glands that says, your survival is at stake. And you either get calmed down, and in the best situation, a caregiver who can really sense that you're experiencing distress that could turn into distress will physically pick you up. You know, we talk about lending our bodies to babies to calm them down, to show them physically what it's like. I mean, when you think of a child that's just flipping out, you know, with rage because, you know, I am hungry, I am wet, I am bored, or whatever it is, and, you know, you big monkeys are not paying attention to me, you know, children are going to use the tools that they have to get your attention. And we are very good at responding. It's pretty difficult for most grown-ups to ignore that crying baby. You know, we might pretend, you know, especially at an airport, you know, you just hunker down even, you know, more behind that newspaper, but you are very focused on that child's distress. I mean, we are really keyed into, especially the very powerful reaction that we have to a child's signals of distress. And so when we meet that need, and even if we don't really know what it is that the child needs at the time, well, you know, you just ate and, you know, look like you have a pin jabbing into you or your diaper's dry. I don't really know what it is, but at least I'm going to try. I'm going to be in this dance back and forth. And oftentimes, what's most important for the child is just that ongoing dialogue of, okay, I'm going to pick you up. I'm talking to you. I'm slowing my voice down. I'm probably going to slow my bodily movements down. Even I, who loves to talk, will probably stop talking.
Are you saying sticking a pin in an infant does not develop more neural connections, but rather stops them, and that they only develop when the pin is done and you've picked up the child?
Lecture over.
Or isn't there a stress response that certainly is going to build new neurological pathways?
The stress response will, and that is, it's an important part of the discussion about stress to mark the difference between everyday stress, which is not having a need met right away, or being told no, or being made to share, manageable but big stresses like the death of a pet or the death of a loved one or a natural disaster, and then the kind of chronic ongoing stress that results from abuse or neglect, substance abuse, depression, especially maternal depression. And so children do need to handle, you know, what is it like to experience that stress of physical discomfort of, you know, we don't use diaper pins so much anymore, but, you know, of not being fed when you're hungry right away and having to wait, having to depend on the grown-ups to eventually attend to your need. Those manageable stresses are part of everyday life, and we do our children a disservice when we don't show them, you know, how is it that we handle and manage those everyday stresses. We need that to be healthy. And it's those nurturing relationships that buffer children. And so you are building important neural pathways of very famous research by Megan Gunner, who is one of the most brilliant researchers in pediatric medicine, has looked at what happens to children both in terms of their external behavior and their internal physiologic response when they experience a stress event like getting a shot. And so she's followed children who were in nurturing relationships, I mean, not perfect relationships, whatever that is, but, you know, a normal relationship where usually it's the mother is right there with the child attending to their needs, goes in to get a shot, and early in the child's career, like at 2 months, the kid gets a shot, and that cortisol response, which is the stress hormone that our body produces when we experience a threat to our body, is tip-top, really skyrockets. 2 months later, at 4 months old, that child comes back in and gets a shot. It's the same loving relationship, and that child has had 2 more months of experience of their needs being attended to. Even if things that are bad happen to them, this person that's there with them now in the office is the person that takes care of them. They get a shot, and the cortisol response internally is half of what it was even 2 months ago. Now, the external behavior is still crying. The child doesn't like to be jabbed with the sharp needle, but they've already learned at 4 months old that the person who's there with them will comfort them. And so in terms of the neural pathways that are being formed, I mean, there is very compelling evidence about what happens when kids are left to manage stress on their own, which is the brain goes into survival mode and your learning is really going to be compromised because your body is telling you you're not safe.
At what age does fight or flight finally kick in?
Well, you know, that it gets more nuanced as we get older and have more capacity.
Well beyond age six then, because we had the slide that showed the maximum or the most dense at age six and then becoming less dense.
You know, you can see the fight or flight response in that two-month-old.
You can.
Already. Okay. You know, again, it's innate. You know, it's part of our survival mechanism, is our ability to go into a stress response, to have the blood flow from our our internal organs to the big muscles in case we either need to try and look big, you know, to scare away an opponent or to try and fight back. So, you know, again, if that gets triggered too much and too early, then the brain sets its sort of stress response thermostat at a much lower level than is optimal. And so that kid is going to be triggered into a stress response much more readily than another child who had been in a nurturing relationship. You know, it's the difference between the kid who, after a fire drill, can calm down and say, wow, you know, that was pretty exciting. And, you know, we were right in the middle of doing this activity, and the fire bell went off, and we all had to go outside. And, you know, then they come back in, they take a couple deep breaths, and, you know, after a couple minutes, they're right back to hearing what the teacher has to say and back in their work groups. Versus the child who heard that bell go off and the stress response threshold for that child was much lower, it's going to take a lot more work to bring that child back to a state where they can calm down. They're going to be bouncing off the walls for half an hour as opposed to the child who had a much, much better start at handling the stress. And it doesn't mean that that kid can't learn good techniques for managing stress, but it just means that we've made that kid have to work a lot harder to respond to the normal kinds of stresses that we could expect a child of that age to take a couple deep breaths, get over it, and get back to work. So the brain can do it, and the brain wants to work hard, but it's going to require a lot more oxygen and a lot more glucose for that brain to do the task compared to the child next to them that isn't having to fight the need to calm down, you know, take a couple deep breaths, focus their attention.
Now, when we're looking at early childhood development as far as the connections with education, when they're ready for education, or to be educated when they get to school, what are some of the things that that will help a normal parent do that will make a difference for when those kids get to school?
Everything, you know, everything matters, you know. That's why there are so many good things that you can choose from in terms of public investments that are really going to yield. It doesn't mean you have to do everything, but it means you have a wide menu of things to choose from. And I am really coming from a bias of saying that public investment, any kind of investment, but especially public investment, will do the most good if you start earliest. And you will have the most dramatic gains, you know, as Rob did a very eloquent job of showing, when you are focusing very high quality, intensive resources where the need is the most vulnerable. So you can invest resources across a broad population and say generalized messages about how important that nurturing bond is for parents to provide for their children, how important it is for them to have better information about early childhood development so their expectations are realistic. You know, that's a huge service that can come under the umbrella of government's responsibility to provide good public health information. And another important role that government can play in terms of really supporting parents is to help parents be wise consumers of childcare and all of the different kinds of early learning opportunities that in this country, for the most part, parents bear on their own at a time when financially, typically, most families are least able to afford those expenditures. So helping parents make good decisions about childcare, because parents, irrespective of maternal employment patterns, are choosing to have their children experience different kinds of childcare settings, either family, friend, and neighbor care, or center-based care, or preschools. So helping to set standards for, you know, what quality looks like is a very appropriate role for governments that many states are doing. I'm leading the effort in Washington State and our task force to try and come up with a quality rating and improvement system. You know, looking at ways to clarify expectations for what you want your children in Alaska to be able to know and do by the time they get to kindergarten, and then dial that backwards to say, what are the practical strategies that we can employ to help get all of our kids to this skill level, and what does it look like in different communities across our state? You know, because there are many different cultural ways that we nurture our children.
I think you're after a lot of stimulation in early childhood, but then if you overstimulate, and you're asking us to know as first-time parents mm-hmm. where that line is.
Mm-hmm.
Even as fourth-time parents, we wonder where that line
is. Overstimulation is a huge issue, and it's a huge issue for very well-intentioned parents today. There's a phenomenon, I don't know who coined the term, of helicopter parenting, you know, where these parents are, you know, hovering over the children, you know, and really not letting the children have their own experiences and putting so much adult-directed agendas on the children that they're really stressing them out. So again, some kids can handle that. I would say most, you know, need that individualized balance of...
I'm going to guess it's the DNA ticket, that simply allows you in the door, and now once you're in the door, it's whichever door the DNA lets you in, now your parenting does the most it can to enhance that. That's why some people become firefighters and some people become accountants. No offense, but... and some people do snowboarding in the Olympics and...
Well, genes are, you know, at least half the story, and experience is the other half. And at least right now, I mean, I can't do anything about the genes I got from my parents. Maybe in the future I can.
You can blame them.
Well, you know, and parental guilt is a force in the universe that works. Can be marshaled for the good.
Works for all of us.
You know what? Now, I'm looking at the clock.
Yes.
And,
yep.
I absolutely love this, but I'm looking at the clock, and I also know that Nancy Murkowski is waiting for you guys over at the... are you supposed to
bad
be
bad form to at keep 4:30? The first lady waiting.
Are you supposed to? Okay. So yes. I know that we probably have to close this. I just want to know, want to make the comments that it's so wonderful that we have somebody out there, all across the state in all different settings, that you're willing to come forward and work on this. The Early Childhood Development Task Force is doing some really exciting things. And I'm really looking forward to in May when you come forward with your recommendations. I hope that we'll still be here so that you can come before the committee and give us a presentation.
You're in session until May?
But we are in session until May. Actually, May 9th and maybe longer.
Maybe longer, but hopefully not.
Hopefully we'll be done.
But if we're in special session after the deadline, it's only for the issues that are in special session by the rules of the governor. So we do have this deadline of, is it 9th or 10th or 11th, and then we can't avoid that focus.
Breathe deep. It's good for your brain.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. However, I don't know how to get there, but we really can't wait till May for input from you as to what needs to go forward, because our funding schedule is not starting in May. It's ended in May. And so we were dealing with this last night, in fact, in the closeout of the Department of Education budget, and trying to figure out, you know, there was just a ballpark $750,000 number there, and we couldn't do anything with that because we didn't know what that represented. So I would encourage you to be able to get us some outline of some portions of what need to be done so that we can look at including that in the budget as we go forward. Because just a big figure in the end, if that's not needed, you know, for the first year, if that's not, you know, if you can identify more clearly what that's going to do, and that may be what you've been involved in, but we need it as soon as possible so that we can aid you in the, you know, in getting the ball rolling.
Yeah, because we'd like, the three of us, believe me, would like to see that in the budget. And, but we have to have, we have to know what's it going to do, and why is it needed? And we, you know, we need some ammunition to help get it in there.
What is, let me ask, what is your time frame on having that information?
Well, go ahead.
You know, it's, we're doing the budget, we're closing all those budget subcommittees this week. And in order, I don't, we've already, Kevin Myers has already given that budget subcommittee to the finance committee. And so now it's got, I don't know when the finance committee will be bringing it up, but soon, because we've got to get that budget over to the Senate and then they work on it. So there's several different opportunities to get that money in the budget. You know, we can do it in finance, we can do it on the floor, we can do it when it starts going through the whole thing in the Senate. So it's not a done deal. And
well, Madam Chair, just to clarify things, it is extremely difficult to modify the budget on the floor.
Yeah.
Because agreements are made and all these things are put together that when it goes to the floor, people are committed to support that budget. Otherwise, we just have chaos. So it really needs to be at the finance committee. And, you know, you're talking 2 weeks, 3 weeks, but that's the time frame in which we need some very specific numbers, and the sooner the better. But yeah, if you can have jobs or tasks that are going to be performed with that money, then we can have a much better position of getting it in, other than just a generalized amount for the, you know, for task force duties. It becomes very difficult to get those in.
If it's going to be three people that are going to be employed through it, you know, whatever, or so much for travel, I mean, all of that, and what parts of the state you might want to be looking at, all kinds of things like that, information that will make legislators say, oh, yeah, that's going to help my district. I want to, you know.
If you want to take the freeway, get it in the governor's budget.
Yeah, next year.
It was, and then
the committee took it out.
Okay. Yeah.
So,
but if we can get some explanations of that, we can all have input to the finance subcommittee as well. But like I say, it's just a bulk figure there without any definition is hard to get our hands around. So I appreciate it.
Anyway, thank you very much. It's just about 4:30, so I know you have to go. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And I appreciate that you all stayed to give it a second round. And but I think it was worth it.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'll adjourn.